This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City by Matthew Desmond. Read for you by Dion Graham. For Michelle, who's been down the line. I wish the rent was heaven sent. Langston Hughes, Little Lyric, of Great Importance. Author's Note. This is a work of nonfiction. Most of the events described in this book took place between May 2008 and December 2009. Except where indicated in the notes, all the events that occurred within that time period were witnessed firsthand. All quotations were captured by a digital recorder or copied from official documents. The names of tenants, their children, and their relatives, as well as landlords and their workers, have been changed to protect their privacy. Prologue. Cold City. Jory and his cousin were cutting up, tossing snowballs at passing cars. From Jory's street corner on Milwaukee's near south side, cars driving on 6th Street passed squat duplexes with porch steps ending at a sidewalk edged in dandelions. Those heading north approached the Basilica of St. Josephat, whose crowning dome looked to Jory like a giant overturned plunger. It was January of 2008, and the city was experiencing the snowiest winter on record. Every so often, a car turned off 6th Street to navigate Arthur Avenue, hemmed in by the snow, and that's when the boys would take aim. Jory packed a tight one and let it fly. The car jerked to a stop, and a man jumped out. The boys ran inside and locked the door to the apartment where Jory lived with his mother, Arlene, and younger brother, Jafaris. The lock was cheap, and the man broke down the door with a few hard-heeled kicks. He left before anything else happened. When the landlord found out about the door, she decided to evict Arlene and her boys. They had been there 8 months. The day Arlene and her boys had to be out was cold. But if she waited any longer, the landlord would summon the sheriff, who would arrive with a gun, a team of boot-footed movers, and a folded judge's order saying that her house was no longer hers. She would be given two options, truck or curb. Truck would mean that her things would be loaded into an 18-footer and later checked into bonded storage. She could get everything back after paying $350. Arlene didn't have $350, so she would have opted for curb, which would mean watching the movers pile everything onto the sidewalk. Her mattresses, a floor model television, her copy of Don't Be Afraid to Discipline, her nice glass dining table, and the lace tablecloth that fit just so. Silk plants, Bibles, the meat cuts in the freezer, the shower curtain, Jafaris's asthma machine. Arlene took her sons. Jory was 13. Jafaris was 5, to a homeless shelter, which everyone called the Lodge, so you could tell your kids, we're staying at the Lodge tonight, like it was a motel. The two-story stucco building could have passed for one, except for all the Salvation Army signs. Arlene stayed in the 120-bed shelter until April, when she found a house on 19th and Hampton, in the predominantly black inner city, on Milwaukee's north side, not far from her childhood home. It had thick trim around the windows and doors, and was once Kendall Green, but the paint had faded and chipped so much over the years that the bare wood siding was now exposed, making the house look camouflaged. At one point, someone had started repainting the house plain white, but had given up mid-brushstroke, leaving more than half unfinished. There was often no water in the house, and Jory had to bucket out what was in the toilet. But Arlene loved that it was spacious and set apart from other houses. It was quiet, she remembered. And $5.25 for a whole house, two bedrooms upstairs and two bedrooms downstairs, it was my favorite place. After a few weeks, the city found Arlene's favorite place unfit for human habitation, removed her, nailed green boards over the windows and doors, and issued a fine to her landlord. Arlene moved Jory and Jafaris into a drab apartment complex deeper in the inner city on Atkinson Avenue, which she soon learned was a haven for drug dealers. She feared for her boys. Especially Jory, slack-shouldered with pecan-brown skin and a beautiful smile, who would talk to anyone. Arlene endured 4 summer months on Atkinson before moving into a bottom duplex unit on 13th Street in Keefe, a mile away. she and the boys walked their things over. Arlene held her breath and tried the lights, smiling with relief when they came on. She could live off someone else's electricity bill for a while. There was a fist-sized hole in a living room window. The front door had to be locked with an ugly wooden plank dropped into metal brackets, and the carpet was filthy and ground in. But the kitchen was spacious, and the living room well lit. Arlene stuffed a piece of clothing into the window hole and hung ivory curtains. The rent was $550 a month, utilities not included, the going rate in 2008 for a two-bedroom unit in one of the worst neighborhoods in America's fourth poorest city. Arlene couldn't find a cheaper place, at least not one fit for human habitation, and most landlords wouldn't rent her a smaller one on account of her boys. The rent would take 88% of Arlene's $628 a month welfare check. Maybe she could make it work. Maybe they could at least stay through winter until crocuses and tulips stabbed through the thawed ground of spring, Arlene's favorite season. There was a knock at the door. It was the landlord, Sharina Tarver. Sharina, a black woman with bobbed hair and fresh nails, was loaded down with groceries. She had spent $40 of her own money and picked up the rest at a food pantry. She knew Arlene needed it. Arlene thanked Sharina and closed the door. Things were off to a good start. Even in the most desolate areas of American cities, evictions used to be rare. They used to draw crowds. Eviction riots erupted during the Depression, even though the number of poor families who faced eviction each year was a fraction of what it is today. A New York Times account of community resistance to the eviction of three Bronx families in February 1932 observed, "Probably because of the cold, the crowd numbered only 1,000. Sometimes neighbors confronted the marshals directly, sitting on the evicted family's furniture to prevent its removal or moving the family back in despite the judge's orders. The marshals themselves were ambivalent about carrying out evictions. It wasn't why they carried a badge and a gun. These days, there are sheriff squads whose full-time job is to carry out eviction and foreclosure orders. There are moving companies specializing in evictions, their crews working all day, every weekday. There are hundreds of data mining companies that sell landlords' tenant screening reports listing past evictions and court filings. These days, housing courts swell, forcing commissioners to settle cases in hallways or makeshift offices crammed with old desks and broken file cabinets. And most tenants don't even show up. Low-income families have grown used to the rumble of moving trucks, the early morning knocks at the door, the belongings lining the curb. Families have watched their incomes stagnate, or even fall, while their housing costs have soared. Today, the majority of poor renting families in America spend over half of their income on housing, and at least one in four dedicates over 70% to paying the rent and keeping the lights on. Millions of Americans are evicted every year because they can't make rent. In Milwaukee, a city of fewer than 105,000 renter households, landlords evict roughly 16,000 adults and children each year. That's 16 families evicted through the court system daily. But there are other ways, cheaper and quicker ways, for landlords to remove a family than through court order. Some landlords pay tenants a couple $100 to leave by the end of the week. Some take off the front door. Nearly half of all forced moves experienced by renting families in Milwaukee are informal evictions that take place in the shadow of the law. If you count all forms of involuntary displacement, formal and informal evictions, landlord foreclosures, building condemnations, you discover that between 2009 and 2011, more than 1 in 8 Milwaukee renters experienced a forced move. There is nothing special about Milwaukee when it comes to eviction. The numbers are similar in Kansas City, Cleveland, Chicago, and other cities. In 2013, 1 in 8 poor renting families nationwide were unable to pay all of their rent, and a similar number thought it was likely they would be evicted soon. This book is set in Milwaukee, but it tells an American story. Evicted follows 8 families, some black, some white, some with children, some without, swept up in the process of eviction. The evictions take place throughout the city, embroiling not only landlords and tenants, but also kin and friends, lovers and ex-lovers, judges and lawyers, dope suppliers and church elders. Eviction's fallout is severe. Losing a home sends families to shelters, abandoned houses, and the street. It invites depression and illness, compels families to move into degrading housing in dangerous neighborhoods, uproots communities, and harms children. Eviction reveals people's vulnerability and desperation, as well as their ingenuity and guts. Fewer and fewer families can afford a roof over their head. This is among the most urgent and pressing issues facing America today, and acknowledging the breadth and depth of the problem changes the way we look at poverty. For decades, we've focused mainly on jobs, public assistance, parenting, and mass incarceration. No one can deny the importance of these issues, but something fundamental is missing. We have failed to fully appreciate how deeply housing is implicated in the creation of poverty. Not everyone living in a distressed neighborhood is associated with gang members, parole officers, employers, social workers, or pastors. But nearly all of them have a landlord. Part 1. Rent. 1. The business of owning the city. Before the city yielded to winter, as cold and gray as a mechanic's wrench, before Arlene convinced Sharina Tarver to let her boys move into the 13th Street duplex, the inner city was crackling with life. It was early September, and Milwaukee was enjoying an Indian summer. Music rolled into the streets from car speakers as children played on the sidewalk or sold water bottles by the freeway entrance. Grandmothers watched from porch chairs as bare-chested black boys laughingly made their way to the basketball court. Sharina wound her way through the north side, listening to R&B with her window down. Most middle-class Milwaukeeans zoomed past the inner city on the freeway. Landlords took the side streets, typically not in their Saab or Audi, but in their rent collector, some oil-leaking, rusted-out van or truck that hauled around extension cords, ladders, maybe a loaded pistol, plumbing snakes, toolboxes, a can of mace, nail guns, and other necessities. Sharina usually left her lipstick-red Camaro at home and visited tenants in a beige and brown 1993 Chevy Suburban with 22-inch rims. The Suburban belonged to Quentin, Sharina's husband, business partner, and property manager. He used a screwdriver to start it. Some white Milwaukeeans still referred to the north side as the core, as they did in the 1960s, and if they ventured into it, they saw street after street of sagging duplexes, fading murals, 24-hour daycares, and corner stores with WIC accepted here signs. Once America's 11th largest city, Milwaukee's population had fallen below 600,000, down from over 740,000 in 1960. It showed. Abandoned properties and weedy lots where houses once stood dotted the north side. A typical residential street had a few single-family homes owned by older folks who tended gardens and hung American flags. More duplexes or four-family apartment buildings with chipping paint and bedsheet curtains rented to struggling families, and vacant plots and empty houses with boards drilled over their doors and windows. Sharina saw all this, but she saw something else, too. Like other seasoned landlords, she knew who owned which multifamily, which church, which bar, which street, knew its different vicissitudes of life, its shades and moods, knew which blocks were hot and drug-soaked, and which were stable and quiet. She knew the ghetto's value, and how money could be made from a property that looked worthless to people who didn't know any better. Petite with chestnut skin, Sharina wore a lightweight red and blue jacket that matched her pants, which matched her off-kilter MBA cap. She liked to laugh, a full, open-mouthed hoot, sometimes catching your shoulder as if to keep from falling. But as she turned off North Avenue on her way to pay a visit to tenants who lived near the intersection of 18th and Wright Streets, she slowed down and let out a heavy sigh. Evictions were a regular part of the business, but Lamar didn't have any legs. Sharina was not looking forward to evicting a man without legs. When Lamar first fell behind, Sharina didn't reach automatically for the eviction notice or shrug it off with a bromide about business being business. She hemmed and hawed. "I'm going to have a hard time doing this," she told Quentin when she could no longer ignore it. "You know that, don't you?" Sharina frowned. Quentin stayed quiet and let his wife say it. "It's only fair," Sharina offered after a few silent moments of deliberation. "I feel bad for the kids. Lamar's got them little boys in there. And I love Lamar. But love don't pay the bills. Sharina had a lot of bills. Mortgage payments, water charges, maintenance expenses, property taxes. Sometimes a major expense would come out of nowhere. A broken furnace, an unexpected bill from the city, and leave her close to broke until the first of the month. "We don't have the time to wait," Quentin said. "While we're waiting on his payment, the taxes are going up. The mortgage payment is going up." There was no hedging in this business. When a tenant didn't pay $500, her landlord lost $500. When that happened, landlords with mortgages dug into their savings, or their income, to make sure the bank didn't hand them a foreclosure notice. There were no euphemisms either, no downsizing, no quarterly losses. Landlords took the gains and losses directly. They saw the deprivation and waste up close. Old-timers liked recalling their first big loss, their initial breaking in, the time a tenant tore down her own ceiling, took pictures and convinced the court commissioner it was the landlord's fault. The time an evicted couple stuffed socks down the sinks and turned the water on full blast before moving out. Rookie landlords hardened or quit. Sharina nodded reassuringly and said, almost to herself, "I guess I gotta stop feeling sorry for these people because nobody's feeling sorry for me. Last time I checked, the mortgage company still wanted their money." Sharina and Quentin had met years ago on Fond du Lac Avenue. Quentin pulled up beside Sharina at a red light. She had a gorgeous smile and her car stereo was turned up. He asked her to pull over. Sharina remembered Quentin being in a Daytona, but he insisted it was the Regal. "I ain't trying to pull nobody over in the Daytona," he'd say, feigning offense. Quentin was well-manicured, built but not muscular, with curly hair and lots of jewelry, a thick chain, a thicker bracelet, rings. Sharina thought he looked like a dope dealer, but gave him her real number anyway. Quentin called Sharina for 3 months before she agreed to let him take her out for ice cream. It took him another 6 years to marry her. When Quentin pulled Sharina over, she was a fourth-grade teacher. She talked like a teacher, calling strangers honey and offering motherly advice or chiding. "You know I'm fixing to fuss at you," she would say. If she sensed your attention starting to drift, she would touch your elbow or thigh to pull you back in. 4 years after meeting Quentin, Sharina was happy with their relationship, but bored at work. After 8 years in the classroom, she quit and opened a daycare. But they shut it down on a tiny technicality, she remembered. So she went back to teaching. After her son from an earlier relationship started acting out, she began homeschooling him and tried her hand at real estate. When people asked why real estate, Sharina would reply with some talk about long-term residuals or property being the best investment out there. But there was more to it. Sharina shared something with other landlords, an unbending confidence that she could make it on her own without a school or a company to fall back on, without a contract or a pension or a union. She had an understanding with the universe that she could strike out into nothing and through her own gumption and intelligence come back with a good living. Sharina had bought a home in 1999 when prices were low. Riding the housing boom a few years later, she refinanced and pulled out $21,000 in equity. 6 months later, she refinanced again, this time pulling $12,000. She used the cash to buy her first rental property, a two-unit duplex in the inner city, where housing was cheapest. Rental profits, refinancing, and private real estate investors offering high-interest loans helped her buy more. She learned that the rental population comprised some upper and middle class households who rent out of preference or circumstance, some young and transient people, and most of the city's poor, who were excluded both from home ownership and public housing. Landlords operated in different neighborhoods, typically clustering their properties in a concentrated area. In the segregated city, this meant that landlords focused on housing certain kinds of people, white ones or black ones, poor families or college students. Sharina decided to specialize in renting to the black poor. 4 years later, she owned 36 units, all in the inner city, and took to carrying a pair of cell phones with backup batteries, reading Forbes, renting office space, and accepting appointments from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Quentin quit his job and started working as Sharina's property manager and buying buildings of his own. Sharina started a credit repair business and an investment business. She purchased two 15-passenger vans and started Prisoner Connections LLC, which for $25 to $50 a seat transported girlfriends and mothers and children to visit their incarcerated loved ones upstate. Sharina had found her calling, inner-city entrepreneur. Sharina parked in front of Lamar's place and reached for a pair of eviction notices. The property sat just off Wright Street, with empty lots and a couple of street memorials for murder victims. Teddy bears, black and mild cigars, and scribbled notes lashed to tree trunks. It was a four-family property consisting of two detached two-story buildings, one directly behind the other. The houses were longer than they were wide, with rough wood balconies painted blue-gray like the trim and vinyl siding that was the brownish white of leftover milk in a cereal bowl. The house facing the street had two doors, for the upper and lower units, and a pair of wooden steps leading to each, one old with peeling paint, the other new and unvarnished. Lamar lived in the lower unit of the back house, which abutted the alley. When Sharina pulled up, he was outside, being pushed in a wheelchair by Patrice, whose name was on the other eviction notice. He had snapped on his plastic prosthetic legs. An older black man, Lamar was wiry and youthful from the waist up, with skin the color of wet sand. He had a shaved head and a thin mustache, flecked with gray. He wore a yellow sports jersey with his keys around his neck. "Oh, I got two at the same time," Sharina tried to say lightly. She handed Lamar and Patrice their eviction notices. "You almost been late," Patrice said. She wore a head wrap, pajama pants, and a white tank top that showed off her tattoo on her right arm, a cross and a ribbon with the names of her three children. At 24, Patrice was half Lamar's age, but her eyes looked older. She and her children lived in the upper unit of the front house. Her mother, Doreen Hinkston, and her three younger siblings lived below her in the bottom floor unit. Patrice creased her eviction notice and jammed it into a pocket. "I'm fixing to go to practice," Lamar said from his seat.
"What practice?"
Sharina asked.
"My kid's football practice."
He looked at the paper in his hand.
"You know, we fixing to do the basement. I'm already started." "He didn't tell me about that,"
Sharina replied. He being Quentin.
Sometimes tenants worked off the rent by doing odd jobs for landlords, like cleaning out basements. "You better call me. Don't forget who the boss is,"
Sharina joked. Lamar smiled back at her.
As Patrice began pushing Lamar down the street, Sharina went over a checklist in her head. There were so many things to deal with. Repairs, collections, moves, advertisements, inspectors, social workers, cops. The swirl of work, a million little things regularly interrupted by some big thing, had been encroaching on her Sunday soul food dinners with her mom. Just a month earlier, someone had been shot in one of her properties. A tenant's new boyfriend had taken three pumps to the chest, and blood had run down him like a full-on faucet. After police officers had asked their questions and balled up the yellow tape, Sharina and Quentin were stuck with the cleanup. Quentin sat on it with a couple guys, rubber gloves, and a shop vac.
"Here you come with a boyfriend that I don't know anything about?"
Sharina asked the tenant. Quentin dealt with messes. Sharina dealt with people. That was the arrangement. Then, a few days after the shooting, another tenant phoned Sharina to say that her house was being shut down. Sharina didn't believe it until she pulled up and spotted white men in hard hats screwing green boards over her windows. The tenants had been caught stealing electricity, so the We Energies men had disconnected service at the pole and placed a call to the Department of Neighborhood Services, DNS. The tenants had to be out that day. In Milwaukee and across the nation, most renters were responsible for keeping the lights and heat on, but that had become increasingly difficult to do. Since 2000, the cost of fuels and utilities had risen by more than 50%, thanks to increasing global demand and the expiration of price caps. In a typical year, almost one in five poor renting families nationwide missed payments and received a disconnection notice from their utility company. Families who couldn't both make rent and keep current with the utility company sometimes paid a cousin or neighbor to reroute the meter. As much as $6 billion worth of power was pirated across America every year. Only cars and credit cards got stolen more. Stealing gas was much more difficult and rare. It was also unnecessary in the wintertime when the city put a moratorium on disconnections. On that April day when the moratorium lifted, gas operators returned to poor neighborhoods with their stacks of disconnection notices and toolboxes. We Energies disconnected roughly 50,000 households each year for non-payment. Many tenants who in the winter stayed current on their rent at the expense of their heating bill tried in the summer to climb back in the black with the utility company by shorting their landlord. Come the following winter, they had to be connected to benefit from the moratorium on disconnection. So every year in Milwaukee, evictions spiked in the summer and early fall and dipped again in November when the moratorium began. Sharina watched the DNS hardhats march around her property. There were few things that frustrated landlords more than clipboard-in-hand building inspectors. When they were not shutting down a property, they were scrutinizing apartments for code violations. Upon request, DNS would send a building inspector to any property. The service was designed to protect the city's most vulnerable renters from negligent landlords. But to Sharina and other property owners, tenants called for small cosmetic things, and often because they were trying to stop an eviction or retaliate against landlords. Sharina thought about the money she had just lost, a few thousand dollars for electrical work and unpaid rent. She remembered taking a chance on this family, feeling sorry for the mother who had told Sharina she was trying to leave her abusive boyfriend. Sharina had decided to rent to her and her children, even though the woman had been evicted 3 times in the past 2 years.
"There's me having a heart again," she thought.
Sharina drove off Wright Street and headed north. Since she was in this part of town, she decided to make one more stop, her duplex on 13th and Keefe. Sharina had let a new tenant move in the previous month with a partial rent and security deposit payment. The tenant was sitting on her stoop in a long-sleeved flannel shirt, hushing a colicky baby and talking with her mother, who was leaning against a car. Seeing Sharina, the young woman wasted no time.
"My son is sick because my house is cold," she said. Her voice was tired. "The window have a hole in it, and I've been waiting patiently. I mean, I'm ready to move."
Sharina tilted her head, confused. The window had a hole, not a crater, and it was warm enough outside that children were still swimming in Lake Michigan. How could the house be cold?
"I done called the city,"
the mother added, peeling herself off the car. She was slender and tall, her hair frizzed by the late summer humidity. Sharina took a breath. There were worse houses on the block, but Sharina knew her place on 13th Street wasn't up to code. She would say almost no house in the city was, a commentary on the mismatch between Milwaukee's worn-out housing stock and its exacting building code. Thanks to the tenant's mother, an inspector would arrive in a few days. He would jiggle the stair banister, photograph the hole in the window, shimmy the unhinged front door. Every code violation would cost Sharina money.
"That wasn't right for you to do that," Sharina said. "Because I was working with her."
"Then fix the window,"
the mother replied.
"We will, but if she don't call us to let us know, she don't have no phone. That's why I called,"
the mother interrupted. As the conversation grew louder, a crowd gathered.
"Who's she?"
a young boy asked.
"Landlord," came a reply. "I didn't know you were going to call the building inspector, Mama,"
the tenant said nervously.
"It's too late now. The damage is done," Sharina said.
She shook her head and, hands on her hips, looked at the young woman with the baby.
"It's always the ones that I try to help that I have the problems out of. And I'm not saying that you're a problem, but it's just that somebody else is involved and you're the one living here. So it puts you in a spot."
"Well, let me ask you something."
The tenant's mother stepped closer, and the crowd with her.
"If this was your daughter and these were your grandkids, what would you do?"
Sharina didn't step back. She looked up at the mother, noticing her gold front tooth, and answered,
"I would have definitely made a connection with the landlord and not called the city."
Sharina pushed past the crowd and stepped briskly to her car. When she got home, she opened the door and yelled,
"Quentin, we done walked straight into some bullshit."
Sharina sat down in her paper-cluttered home office. The office was one of 5 bedrooms in Sharina and Quentin's home, which sat in a quiet, middle-class black neighborhood off Capitol Drive. The house had a finished basement with an inset jacuzzi tub.
Sharina and Quentin had furnished it with beige leather furniture, large brass and crystal light fixtures, and gold-colored curtains. The kitchen was spacious and unused, since they ate out most days. Typically, the only things in the refrigerator were restaurant doggy bags.
Huh?
Quentin called back, coming down the stairs. The girl downstairs at 13th Street? Her mama done called the building inspector. Her mother was outside talking shit. Quentin listened to the story and said,
Put her out.
Sharina thought about it for a moment, then agreed. She reached in a drawer and began filling out a 5-day eviction notice. The law forbade landlords from retaliating against tenants who contacted DNS, but landlords could at any time evict tenants for being behind on rent or for other violations. By the time Quentin and Sharina pulled the Suburban onto 13th Street, night had fallen. The apartment door was open. Sharina walked right through it without knocking and handed the young tenant an eviction notice, saying, Here, I hope you get some assistance. A man followed Sharina out the door and stood on the unlit porch.
Excuse me? He called out as Sharina met Quentin in the street. You're evicting her?
She told me she wanted to move, so that let me know she wasn't going to pay anything else, Sharina answered.
She told you she wanted the windows fixed.
Quentin interjected, looking at Sharina.
He ain't got nothing to do with it.
I got everything to do with it, blood. This my stepdaughter here. You don't even stay here, though, man, Quentin yelled back. Ain't nobody want to live like that. Fuck you mean, I don't have nothing to do with it.
Quentin opened the Suburban's door and pulled out his security belt, equipped with handcuffs, a small baton, and a canister of mace the size of a small fire extinguisher. Quentin had been here before. There was the tenant who told him he was going to take his security deposit out of Quentin's pocket. There was the one who said he was going to shoot him in the face. The tenant's mother joined the stepfather on the dark porch.
Are you evicting her?
She asked.
She didn't pay her rent, Sharina said.
Do y'all have her rent to pay?
I don't give a shit, man,
the stepfather was saying almost to himself. What he didn't give a shit about wasn't the eviction, but whatever was going to transpire there at that very moment, on that dark street.
I don't either,
Quentin shot back.
I'll whip that motherfucking ass, nigga. Don't say I ain't got nothing to do with it.
You don't,
Sharina yelled as Quentin tugged her back to the Suburban.
You don't!
Days after the tenant left, Sharina took a call from a caseworker at Wraparound, a local social services agency. The caseworker had a client who needed a place to live with her two boys. Wraparound would pay her security deposit in first month's rent, which sounded good to Sharina. The new tenant's name was Arlene Bell. 2. Making rent. Sometime after Sharina paid him a visit with her eviction notice, Lamar was back in his apartment on 18th and Wright, playing spades with his two sons and their friends. As always, they sat around a small kitchen table, slapping the playing cards hard on the wood or sending them spinning with a calm flick of the wrist. The neighborhood boys knew they could show up at Lamar's place day or night for a bite to eat, a drag off a blunt if they were lucky, and a romping game of spades.
You ain't got no more spades, Negro? Look, we gonna set they ass.
Lamar was partnered with Buck. At 18, Buck was the oldest of the crew and went by Big Bro. They sat across from each other, playing Luke, Lamar's 16-year-old son, and DeMarcus, one of Luke's closest friends. Eddie, Lamar's younger son at 15, worked the stereo while four other neighborhood boys stood around, waiting their turn at spades. Lamar sat in his wheelchair. His prosthetic legs, each one foot to top shin, stood beside his bed, casting a human-like shadow on the rough wood floor.
Police crazy, Buck offered, inspecting his hand.
He was finishing high school and working part-time in its cafeteria, where he had to wear a hairnet to cover his thick cornrows. Buck slept at his parents' house but lived at Lamar's. If someone asked him why, he would study his size 12 boots and just say,
Cause.
The boys usually walked to the store or football practice together, strutting 9 or 10 deep down Wright Street. Being stopped by the Milwaukee PD had become routine. This was why, when someone made a run to the weed spot, he usually went alone.
Next time I'm gonna be like, what you stopping me for?
Buck went on.
Cause you have a right to ask him.
They gotta see, smell, hear, or something.
They ain't gotta see nothing, Lamar replied.
Yes, they do, Pops. They teaching me this at school.
They teaching you wrong, then.
DeMarcus laughed and put a cigarette lighter to a blunt he had just licked shut. He drew in and passed it. The game got underway, quick at first, then slower as players' hands thinned.
When the police come up, Buck persisted, even if they pull you over, you ain't even gotta let your window down. You just gotta roll it down a little bit.
It ain't that sweet, Lamar grinned.
Nah, Pops.
Don't be trying to change things, man, cut in DeMarcus, who had just been arrested because of his slick mouth, according to Lamar.
A hard head makes a soft ass.
The laughter lifted higher when Lamar added,
Can't call me collect.
He took a drag off the blunt.
Baby boy,
his voice was tender.
I'm 51. If it's happened, I've been through it.
The police ain't protecting us, Buck said.
I feel you on that, but all polices are not the same. If I was in the neighborhood and it was rough, I'd want the police to clean that shit up too.
Lamar tossed out the King of Diamonds and looked left to DeMarcus.
Go ahead, son. Get it out your hand.
The ace had already been played, and he figured DeMarcus had the queen. DeMarcus looked back at Lamar, poker-faced, through thick glasses.
Pops, your neighborhood protects you. If somebody comes through shooting, everybody on the block, everybody who got, hauling off shooting.
Man, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I know I can shoot.
Lamar had joined the Navy in 74 after seeing a commercial. He was 17. The Navy was a blur of boring oceans, exotic locations, shore leave parties, pills, and blown checks. Lamar couldn't see why all the floppy-haired college students down in Madison had gone crazy over Vietnam, getting their noggins thumped by police batons and blowing up a university building. Lamar was having a blast. He was dishonorably discharged in 1977.
But a bullet ain't got no eyes, Lamar continued. Man, look here. We went to court with DeMarcus.
The game stopped while Lamar told the story. Before DeMarcus's case was called, Lamar said, they had watched a teenager sentenced to 14 years for accompanying his older brother when he beat a crackhead to death.
He's in the courtroom bawling his eyes out.
They on some bull 'cause he a little black boy, Buck said.
Well then, that should make you think, being black.
As Buck laughed, DeMarcus slapped his card down. The eight of spades.
Ah, that's what my mama taught me,
he yelled. Next to all other suits, the spade was the most powerful. DeMarcus slid the book to his pile.
Damn, Lamar said.
Then he looked back at Buck.
It ain't worth it, doing stupid stuff. Prison ain't no joke. You gotta fight every day in prison, for your life.
I know, but when I get mad, to the extent that I want to do something, ain't nothing stopping me.
You better grow up, kid.
As Buck took a long hit off the blunt, Lamar added,
And you need to slow down, smoker.
He drew the last word out, using a high-pitched, tinny voice. Buck laughed so hard he lost his hit, but the point got through.
I'm straight,
he demurred the next time the blunt was offered. When his sons were at school, Lamar listened to oldies while he cleaned and drank instant coffee with sugar. He pushed forward in his wheelchair, set the brake, and swept the dirt into a long-handled dustpan. Instead of stacking the boys into a single bedroom, Lamar had given Luke one bedroom and Eddie the other, their twin beds resting on metal frames. Lamar's bed sat in the corner of the living room. On the other side was a moss-green couch, team photographs from past football seasons, white silk flowers, and a small fish tank with guppies. The apartment was spare and tidy, full of light. Its pantry bordered on obsessive-compulsive. The spam was stacked neatly in its place, the cereal boxes lined up at attention, the cans of soup and beans organized by kind and all forward-facing. Lamar had repurposed a Clos de Bois wine rack to hold a small stereo, dishes, and the Folgers can where he kept his tobacco and Midnight Special rolling papers. The place had come a long way. When Lamar first came to look at the apartment, it was a mess, with maggots sprouting from unwashed dishes in the kitchen. But Lamar needed a home. He and his sons had been sharing a room in the basement of his mother's house,
She gave all of them a 9 p.m. curfew and saw the place had promise. Sharina had waived Lamar's security deposit. She thought he would be approved for supplemental security income, SSI, a monthly stipend for low-income people who are either elderly or have mental or physical disabilities. But that hadn't worked out yet. After school let out for the day, the boys would start showing up at Lamar's, sometimes with and sometimes without Luke and Eddie. Most evenings, by nightfall, everyone would have chipped in for a blunt or two and the cards would come out. Lamar's approach with his sons, and the boys he treated like sons, was open and avuncular. "You can't hide nothing from God," he told them, "so don't hide it from your daddy. Do what you do at home. I'd rather for you to do it at home around me than out there on them street corners." As Lamar smoked and laughed with the boys, he handed down advice about work, sex, drugs, cops, life. When the boys complained about girls, Lamar would try to even the scales. "You've been talking about girls, but it's the men, though, that be messing up on them." Lamar reviewed the boys' report cards and nagged them about finishing their homework. "They think I'm partying with them. I'm watching them." Lamar could watch them because he was not always away, pulling a long shift. Plenty of people on his block worked. The boys hardly saw those people, except when they dashed to their cars, uniforms pressed. Lamar had worked several jobs after leaving the Navy. He worked as a janitor at multiple places. He drove a forklift and poured chemicals for Athea Laboratories. After he lost his legs, he applied for SSI, but was twice denied because, Lamar recalled being told, he could still work in his condition. Lamar wouldn't argue with that, but good jobs were scarce. Milwaukee used to be flush with good jobs, but throughout the second half of the 20th century, bosses in search of cheap labor moved plants overseas or to Sunbelt communities, where unions were weaker or didn't exist. Between 1979 and 1983, Milwaukee's manufacturing sector lost more jobs than during the Great Depression, about 56,000 of them. The city where virtually everyone had a job in the post-war years saw its unemployment rate climb into the double digits. Those who found new work in the emerging service sector took a pay cut. As one historian observed, "Machinists in the old Alice Chalmers plant earned at least $11.60 an hour. Clerks in the shopping center that replaced much of that plant in 1987 earned $5.23. These economic transformations, which were happening in cities across America, devastated Milwaukee's black workers, half of whom held manufacturing jobs. When plants closed, they tended to close in the inner city, where black Milwaukeeans lived. The black poverty rate rose to 28% in 1980. By 1990, it had climbed to 42%. There used to be an American Motors plant on Richards and Capitol, on the city's predominantly black north side. It has been replaced by a Walmart. Today in Milwaukee, former leather tanneries line the banks of the Menominee River Valley like mausoleums of the city's golden industrial age. The Schlitz and Pabst breweries have been shuttered, and one in two working-age African-American men doesn't have a job. In the 1980s, Milwaukee was the epicenter of deindustrialization. In the 1990s, it would become the epicenter of the anti-welfare crusade. As President Clinton was fine-tuning his plan to end welfare as we know it, a conservative reformer by the name of Jason Turner was transforming Milwaukee into a policy experiment that captivated lawmakers around the country. Turner's plan was dubbed Wisconsin Works, or W-2. And Works was right. If you wanted a welfare check, you would have to work, either in the private sector or in a community job created by the state. To push things along, child care and health care subsidies would be expanded. W-2 meant that people were paid only for the hours they logged on a job, even if that job was to sort little toys into different colors and have the supervisor reshuffle them so they could be sorted again the next day. It meant that non-compliers could have their food stamps slashed. It meant that 22,000 Milwaukee families would be cut from the welfare rolls. 5 months after Milwaukee established the first real work program in the history of welfare, Clinton signed welfare reform into federal law. When W-2 fully replaced aid to families with dependent children in 1997, it provided two types of monthly stipends.
$673 for beneficiaries who worked, and $628 for those who didn't or couldn't, usually because of a disability. Because Lamar didn't work, he received the lesser amount, known as W-2-T. After paying $550 in rent, Lamar had $78 for the rest of the month. That amounted to $2.19 a day. When Lamar's welfare benefits started, right after he moved into Sharina's apartment, he had mistakenly received two checks. In its Rights and Responsibilities Guide, the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families informed clients who have been overpaid, "You may have to repay benefits you received by mistake, regardless of whether it is your fault or the agency's fault." Tell that to a single father trying to raise two teenage boys on a welfare check. Lamar cashed both checks and bought Luke and Eddie shoes, clothes, and school supplies, along with curtains and furniture for their new apartment.
"Of course I spent it. Got my name on it,"
he had said when a caseworker contacted him after discovering the error. The caseworker deducted the overpayment from Lamar's next check, causing him to fall a month behind on rent. Lamar thought the basement job he had done for Sharina and Quentin was worth $250. The basement was covered with mildewed clothes, trash, and dog shit, reminding him of a recurring dream he had where he would crawl into a strange, shadowed basement to buy dope. He refused to ask any of the boys for help, thinking the work beneath them. He cleaned the basement alone, working until his stubs grew too sore. It took him a week. Sharina credited him $50 for it. He still owed her $260. It would have been impossible to get caught up in time by making extra payments. What Lamar had after the rent was paid went to household necessities, soap, toilet paper, and the phone bill. So Lamar sold $150 of food stamps for $75 cash, the going rate in Milwaukee. The refrigerator and pantry would be empty by the end of the month, but Luke and Eddie could ask their grandma for a plate. The other boys already knew to leave Lamar's food alone. It still wasn't enough. If Lamar wanted to keep his home, he needed another hustle. He spotted one when Patrice moved out. Patrice didn't put up much of a fight after Sharina delivered her eviction notice. She had moved upstairs from the lower unit, a two-bedroom, where she and her three small children had been living with her mother, Doreen, and Patrice's younger siblings. When Patrice was served the pink papers, she and her children simply moved back downstairs. When Lamar found out, he figured Sharina would need to repaint the unit. He asked her to let him do it. Sharina agreed, saying she would have Quentin drop off the supplies.
"Tell him to bring extra, baby. I'm putting together a crew."
Buck and DeMarcus showed up, along with Luke, Eddie, and a half-dozen other neighborhood boys who had come to see Lamar's home as their own. They spread out in the spacious two-bedroom apartment, dipped roller and brush into a 5-gallon bucket, and started slathering the walls. They worked earnestly and with a quiet seriousness. After a while, some tossed their hoodies and shirts on the floor, painting bare-chested. Lamar paused to take in the scene. Just the previous winter, he had climbed into an abandoned house, high on crack. When the high wore off, he found he couldn't climb out. His feet had frozen. Lamar kept partying after returning home from the Navy. In the mid-1980s, crack hit the streets of Milwaukee, and Lamar started smoking it. He got hooked. His co-workers at Athea knew it because he wouldn't have cigarette money a couple days after payday. Lamar remembered losing his job and apartment. After that, he took Luke and Eddie to shelters and abandoned houses, tearing up the carpet so they could have a blanket at night. Luke and Eddie's mother was around back then, but her addiction eventually consumed her, and she gave up her boys. Lamar ate snow during the days he was trapped in the abandoned house. His feet swelled purple and black with frostbite until they looked like rotten fruit. He was delirious when, on the eighth day, he jumped out of an upper floor window. He would say God threw him out. When he woke up in the hospital, his legs were gone. Except for two brief relapses, he had not smoked crack since.
"I'm blessed," Lamar said, looking at Luke and Eddie.
The white paint misting from the rollers freckled their black skin.
"My boy's okay."
The following month, Sharina was driving through heavy rain. Traffic sounded like 1,000 mop buckets being tossed out the back door.
She was headed to a meeting of the Milwaukee Real Estate Investors Networking Group, Ring, at the Best Western Hotel by the airport, on the far south side of the city. 50 people showed up, including investors, mold assessors, lawyers, and other players in real estate, but the majority of the people in the room were landlords. Men, mostly, young men in ties, many the sons of landlords, but taking notes anyway. Foot-tapping middle-aged men in leather jackets and boots, older men in caps and flannel shirts with knuckles like tree knots. Sharina stood out as a woman, and especially as a black woman. Besides her friend Laura, who had moved from Jamaica 30 years ago, Sharina was the only black person in the room. Almost everyone else was white, with names like Eric, Mark, or Kathy. A couple of generations ago, a gathering like this would have been virtually unheard of. Many landlords were part-timers, machinists or preachers or police officers who came to own property almost by accident, through inheritance, say, and saw real estate as a side gig. But the last 40 years had witnessed the professionalization of property management. Since 1970, the number of people primarily employed as property managers had more than quadrupled. As more landlords began buying more property and thinking of themselves primarily as landlords instead of people who happened to own the unit downstairs, professional associations proliferated, and with them, support services, accreditations, training materials, and financial instruments. According to the Library of Congress, only three books offering apartment management advice were published between 1951 and 1975. Between 1976 and 2014, the number rose to 215. Even if most landlords in a given city did not consider themselves professionals, housing had become a business. The evening speaker was Ken Shields from the Self-Storage Brokers of America. After selling his insurance company, Shields had begun looking for a way to get into real estate. He started out with rooming houses, which meant he started out renting mainly to poor single men. "Very nice cash flow, but I no longer have them." The room chuckled. "I made some good money, and I mean, I love to get money, but I'm still just as happy not running around and dealing with some of these dregs of society who live in rooming houses." Sharina, who owned a couple of rooming houses, laughed along with the room. Then Shields found self-storage. "It's got the residual incomes of an apartment building, but," he lowered his voice, squinted, "you don't have the people. You just got their stuff. This is the sweetest spot in the whole American economy, a receptacle for an enormous cascade of money." The landlords loved Ken Shields, even if he did live in Illinois. When he finished his speech, the room broke into applause. The Ring president, a mustached man with a full pouch for a stomach, stood up, clapping. When there wasn't a speaker, he often organized round robins. One such evening, a woman from Lead and Asbestos Information Center, Incorporated, had started off by announcing, "There is money to be made on lead," to a room of landlords who more often lost money trying to abate it. One landlord asked whether he would have to report the presence of asbestos to the city or the tenants if he tested for it. "No, you don't," the woman had said. The conversation moved on, and someone else had asked about garnishing wages. A lawyer informed the room that a landlord was allowed to garnish a tenant's bank account and up to 20% of his or her income, but the last $1,000 was exempt, and welfare recipients were off limits. "How about intercepting their tax refund?" Sharina had asked. The lawyer looked a bit stunned. "No, only the governor can do that." Sharina already knew that. She had looked into it before. Her question wasn't a question. It was a message to Eric, Mark, Kathy, and everyone else in the room that she would do almost anything to get the rent. Many white landlords knew money could be made in the inner city, where property was cheap, but the thought of collecting payments on the north side, let alone passing out eviction notices, made them nervous. Sharina wanted them to know that she could help. For the right price, she would manage their property or consult with them about where to buy in the ghetto. She would be their broker to Black Milwaukee. After that meeting, white landlords had surrounded Sharina, who had worn a denim jacket with "Million Dollar Baby" bedazzled in rhinestones on the back. She poked fun as she collected business cards. "Don't be afraid of the north side."
As people started to leave, Sharina and Laura found a quiet spot in the hallway.
I got drama, Sharina began.
Drama for your mama. Me and Lamar Richards are going at it again. The man with no legs? He shorted me on my rent this month.
How much?
Laura's voice, with soft traces of the island accent, belonged to a librarian. She was older than Sharina, and that night was elegantly dressed in dark slacks, gold earrings, and a layered red blouse. She folded her fur-lined coat on her lap.
$30?
Sharina shrugged. But that's not it. It's the principal. He already owes me $260 for that bad job for the painting. When Lamar and the boys had finished painting, he called Sharina, and she came over. She noticed that the boys had not filled in the holes, had dripped white paint on the brown trim, had ignored the pantry. Lamar said Quentin had not dropped off hole filler or brown paint. You're supposed to go and ask for it then, Sharina snapped back. She refused to credit Lamar a cent toward his debt.
And then, Sharina continued, he did his bathroom floor over without my knowledge and deducted $30 out of the rent.
When painting, Lamar had found a box of tile in Patrice's old place and had used it to retile his bathroom floor, securing each piece with leftover paint.
I told him, do not ever deduct any more rent from me ever again.
Plus, how can you deduct when you owe me? Laura recrossed her legs.
He's a player, that's all he is. Time for him to go. They just try to take.
The thing is, Sharina circled back to Lamar's painting job, I would have never paid anybody $260 to do that.
I can get painting done in 5 rooms, $30 a room, $150.
No. Our people do it for $20 a room, $25 at the most.
Exactly.
As far as I'm concerned, he still owes the $260.
Excuse me, now it's $290.
The old friends laughed. It was just what Sharina needed. 3. Hot water. Lenny Lawson stepped out of his trailer park office to burn a Pall Mall. Smoke drifted up past his mustache and light blue eyes and disappeared above a baseball cap. He looked out over the rows of mobile homes bunched together on a skinny strip of asphalt. Almost all the trailers were lined up in the same direction and set a couple steps apart. The airport was close, and even longtime residents looked up when planes came in low, exposing their underbellies and rattling the windows. Lenny had spent his entire life in this place, all 43 years of it, and for the past dozen years he had worked as its manager. Lenny knew the druggies lived mostly on the north side of the trailer park, and the people working double shifts at restaurants or nursing homes lived mostly on the south side. The metal scrappers and can collectors lived near the entrance, and the people with the best jobs, sandblasters, mechanics, congregated on the park's snobby side, behind the office, in mobile homes with freshly swept porches and flower pots. Those on SSI were sprinkled throughout, as were the older folks who went to bed with the chickens and woke up with the chickens, as some park residents like to say. Lenny tried to house the sex offenders near the druggies, but it didn't always work out. He had had to place one near the double shifters. Thankfully, the man never left his trailer or even opened the blinds. Someone delivered food and other necessities to him every week. College Mobile Home Park sat on the far south side of the city, on 6th Street, off College Avenue. It was bordered on one side by overgrown trees, shrubs, and sand pits, and, on the other, by a large truck distribution center. It was a 15-minute walk to the nearest gas station or fast food restaurant. There were other trailer parks nearby, surrounded by streets with modest, tawny brick homes and sharply pitched roofs. This was the part of Milwaukee where poor white folks lived. The Menominee River Valley cuts through the middle of the city and functions like its Mason-Dixon line, dividing the predominantly black north side from the predominantly white south side. Milwaukeeans used to joke that the 16th Street Viaduct, which stretches over the valley, was the longest bridge in the world because it connected Africa to Poland. The biggest effort to change that came in 1967 when 200 demonstrators, almost all of them black, gathered at the north end of the viaduct and began walking to Poland
to protest housing discrimination. As the marchers approached the south side of the bridge, they heard the crowd before they saw it. Chants of "kill, kill," and "we want slaves" rose up above the rock and roll music blasted from loud